Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Did you know that every day in the United States, we are extracting soil's value at the rate of a rail car 116 miles long? So if we think about that, we are losing the value of some of our best soils and regenerative natural resources at a rate that just cannot be replenished by nature. What we have to do is start thinking differently. And why we do this on Sourcing Matters is to bring awareness to consumers that many people are thinking about this differently. In our extractive approach to agriculture, of mining the soils, it just won't scale. So today, we're welcoming another guest who's focused on soil health and who's engaged in focusing on the future of agriculture. But we have a slightly different lens from our guest today, Bill Buckner, who's the president and CEO of the Noble Research Institute. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Aaron, I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. I think this is a great opportunity for our listeners to get an idea of what you're up to. So in doing some research and in previous chats we've had, it looks like the Noble Research Institute is bridging the worlds of conventional and organic through focus on land management and soil health to provide solutions for vast challenges, because you have quite a lineage. You founded in 1945 to revitalize our agricultural infrastructure coming out of the Dust Bowl. And the Noble Research Institute is now 400 people coming from 20 different countries with all types of diverse backgrounds looking at the biggest issues facing humanity. So I did do some analysis and research into your website, and it looks like you have four cornerstones that you're focused on, one being research, another being around producer relations, another around stewardship, and another around education. So, Bill, my first question for you is, can you tell us a little bit about what you're up to down in Oklahoma at the Noble Research Institute?
A lot, Aaron. And I always tell people that when I started with Noble in 2012, having come out of the conventional agricultural realm, this was like coming to nirvana. This was a place, the coolest place I've ever worked, because our trustees, our board, which is predominantly still the family, are very supportive of all of our activities, and for once, I feel like we can really make a difference in the things that we do. So it's really from soup to nuts. I think first and foremost, you mentioned our four cornerstones. We are predominantly a forage-based beef research entity. That means we research and develop new grasses and legumes and brassicas that can be fed to livestock. This is cattle country. But we also do a lot more in terms of understanding that forages are also cover crops. We have a real strong platform that in a nationwide effort to create new cover crop cultivars. It's a big part of building soil health. But we also have the strong educational component, trying to teach kids more about their food and where food comes from, and that's ages 5 through 12, and then we have some university-type programs that we collaborate with Oklahoma State, Oklahoma University, and Texas A&M. The producer relations component is a consulting business, basically. We offer free consultation to upwards of 1,800 producers on any given day. And we take what we call a systems approach in that consultation effort. We really want to understand what the goals and the ideals are for the farmers and ranchers we serve. And when they can express themselves in terms of what those goals and ambitions are, we take a step back and we look at the landscape. And we look at the landscape as a biological life in trying to match their economic conditions and their economic expectations and goals to how that land is actually performing for them to try to achieve those objectives. And it's a different approach than what a lot of people will take with practice-based management approaches to working with farmers and ranchers. And I think that's one of the things that our consultation program does in terms of setting us apart. We start working below the ground and work up and try to get the holistic approach, if you will, for farmer and rancher. And as you indicated at the beginning, we don't discern between organic and conventional. We want to advance the system based upon their expectations and their goals. And of course, our research, we do everything from basic research to translational and applied research, again, trying to improve forage plant cultivars so we can continue to bring advances in genetics to the farmers and ranchers that we serve.
So that's I love that concept of making it a systems conversation and transcending many of the alienating conversations, whether it's organic or conventional. It's really looking at best pragmatic approach for the future of our food systems and the future of agricultural models. So Bill, I do want to take a step back, and you had mentioned that you came from a conventional world and now you're focused on conservation agriculture. And I will say, Bill, so with the name Bill Buckner, as a New Englander, I'm sure you've heard this in the past. I was taken aback at front. I was going to say that you didn't play first base. I know for the Sox in 86, which, you know, that's that we still, as a lifelong New Englander, we still have that shuddering feel. But you're doing great work moving the future of things forward. But I just wanted to share with you, I'm sure with other New Englanders listening, they're going to say, wait a minute, this can't be the same.
And you're not. Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. But you come from a conventional agricultural model, and you have then, I think you said even the last decade, moved into a conservation-based agricultural model. So was it a epiphany moment? Was it a flipping of the switch? Or was it just a practice? Where did you see the light for that?
Well, I think when I was at Bayer, we introduced a product called Poncho Votivo, and that's a seed treatment for corn. And they've since advanced that for soybeans as well. The Poncho piece is an insecticide, and you can always explain to a producer how the insecticide works. It kills bugs. Votivo was a biofungicide. And we really could never, ever describe the function of Votivo. We just knew that there was a crop response that you could convey to a grower, but you didn't have any way of knowing why it worked. And on our farm in Missouri, which is a family farm, we've owned it for over 100 years, our production system was beginning to hit a wall, and in essence being that it was tired. We were having to add more inputs in order to get the same yield whenever we would have these climatic conditions that were adverse to growing a good crop, that being drought or too much rain, and they're becoming more and more prevalent every year. Our system wasn't resilient enough to withstand itself in those conditions. So it was really my brother who is more had more of a conservation bent than I did, and even as old as I am, I'm always ready to learn, and he really forced me to take another hard look at it, and I was still with Bayer at the time, and as I looked, and it just started to dawn on me that the reason we saw a crop response with Votivo was because we were at least applying some agent that was beneficial to that plant environment, which was sick. And I've tried to get in my mind, Aaron, how you really think about a biological system, whether it's humans or animals or soil, they both react and function based on optimal biology. And so, given that, it's no wonder that the inputs that we use keep a plant propped up. And if we think about that, and just in terms of humans, whether it's vitamins we take every day or hormonal shots or whatever, we're always trying to figure out how, as humans, we can create peak performance. But at the same time, if we go out and drink every night and smoke cigarettes, you know, we're going to be trying to prop ourselves up in an unhealthy environment. It's this exact same that's taking place in soil. The key is that when we started the soil renaissance, which I can talk about a little bit later, what we found is that when Leonardo da Vinci said we know more about the planetary heavens than we know about the ground underfoot in the 14th century, the same is true today. And our knowledge of biology is soil biology is so negligent that it really does create an open opportunity and an environment for really intense learning and development of this natural resource further than what we thought that we were doing before in traditional agronomic conditions or conventional agriculture. So we started making that shift on our farm in about 2011, and we started concentrating on building the soil health, but it's not a cold turkey type of thing because you have to have an economic return. So we're not organic today. We still use some herbicides. We still use some insecticides, foliar sprays if we need it. But we have an eye on the goal, and we are cutting back on our input usage. Our soil is performing better than it did. Our organic matter is coming up. So we're going through what we call coming through the veil, where we can get on the other side and look back and say, wow, that was a journey. And most farmers that you talk to that have done that, and there's a lot of them out there, they'll tell you the same thing. It is a journey, and it takes a lot of hand-holding and mentoring from folks that have been there before.
Yeah, and a certain level of trust, right, and which is quite interesting here in the fact that so the Noble Research Institute is the largest independent private agricultural organization in the U.S., from my understanding, and looking at that, of what that role has developed into, when it seems to be at one point more on the conventional side, which is now moving probably under your tutelage into evaluating these programs where you are focused on land stewardship and proper resource conservation to reach that optimal biology. Our best friend is that biology when it works in harmony. And I love your vernacular of the plants in the soil being tired and sick, because that's exactly right. There is a huge correlation between our health and soil health and the way that the systems operate for cycling nutrients and keeping the overall system afloat and healthy, and not just keeping it from getting sicker, but moving it in the right direction. We have healthy systems. So when you had mentioned that you don't focus on an organic or conventional model, and I think that's very unique here, and I think that's a great bridge, which I am excited by what you're establishing in Oklahoma here, is this bridge. Because often, as you probably have seen from the folks that we have on Sourcing Matters, we are surely focused, and we have some of the folks that are really trying to push the envelope in organic and regenerative, and it can be ostracizing. And so I think too often there's a finger cast at the other side. And I think your language, your appropriation of not using that as an alienating model is very exciting. So let me ask you that. For conventional and alternative production, how do we get everyone to have a seat at the table together so we realize we have the same goals?
Well, I think most agriculturalists will, if you ask them what the optimal system would be, it would be farming in nature's way. But there are those that'll say, well, but that's a pipe dream, right? And there are going to be those that say, yes, but you have to stay with it, and you have to be committed to it, you really got to drive your production system in that direction. And so they're all over the board. And I think it, in this day and age where people take sides and they don't try to find that common ground, it's easy to just opt out, because I do believe people have forgotten how to be civil and how to have a conversation about these types of issues and find resolution. So I'll go back to that topic about the soil renaissance. I was sitting with an organic grower from upstate New York. His name's Klaus Martin, and he's probably well known to a lot of the New England states. And one of the smartest men I ever met, and we both belong to an organization called the Farm Foundation. And Klaus and I were having a glass of wine one night and just talking about things. And you know, here's a conventional and an organic grower sitting having this dinner conversation. And we're talking about the things where we can actually make a difference. And it really came down to soil health research and where are the gaps in soil health research. And we just kind of looked at one another and we said, you know what, I think the two of us can convene a group together with Noble Foundation and the Farm Foundation, two guys, organic and conventional, bringing the industry together to sit down and start discussing what are the gaps in soil health research. And that's what Klaus and I did. And we made sure that it was farmer facing of both organic and conventional, because when you put farmers together, they don't do the finger pointing. What happens is we allow trade associations, we allow commodity groups, we allow everybody, that the farm lobbies, to lob these grenades in the middle of a discussion that creates this level of animosity. But when you put farmers together, they want to learn from one another. And it wasn't that a guy chose to be a conventional farmer by choice. That was probably how their father farmed. And you start seeing the amount of technology coming through and the understanding that we have, the equipment that we have today. It allows for people to do different things than what you, than the chances that you perhaps had back in the 1960s, when conventional ag was the rage. New hybrids were coming out, new chemistries were coming out, farming got easier, and that just became part of it. And I think we all have to admit, organic farming is hard work, and conventional farming is easier. And I think that's been kind of that chosen path for a lot of people, depending upon the number of acres they're farming, or whether it's livestock production or what have you. And my point here is that everybody took a path for a reason, but I think everybody would like to find that equilibrium somewhere in the middle that allows for that biological system to function and actually give back to what they're the care that they're providing.
Finding that commonality, and really, I mean, farmers are much healers as anything, right? Both of the land and those that they feed. And almost the oath of the Hippocratic oath of the doctor, it's a similar for a farmer, where you seem to find commonality where others can't. So that's an exciting type conversation that you've had. And so let's take the soil renaissance from 500 years ago. Let's talk about now what you're doing with Farm Foundation and Noble, and fast forward at that to just this February. The Noble Research Institute launched a pragmatic approach to develop and to incubate more farmers to move away from that inherited practice, maybe that their father or grandfather or mother had on their farm. And you've launched environmental service markets, which are focused on improving soil health and really focused on long-term prosperity. So these markets providing a way to add a commoditization structure around soil health, water, and carbon. Could you tell us a bit more about that program and how this multi-year program will be incubated and accelerated through all types of farming infrastructure around the U.S.?
Absolutely. Well, this is kind of a journey, if you will, and it started with the soil renaissance, which morphed into a couple other different stages. One, after that about 2.5 years into the renaissance effort, we had about 150 volunteers working in different committees. And what we uncovered, Aaron, was about 60 years of neglect in the whole area of understanding soil biology, which, as I mentioned earlier, was kind of negligent. But there were a lot of things that needed to be fixed in our understanding of soil health, and most importantly, how do you even measure soil health, and what are those measurement components that needed to be calibrated and reinforced through our lab system across the country. And so with that, Noble decided to invest $20 million over 10 years, so $2 million a year, to stand up the Soil Health Institute, which was taking all of the action plans out of the Renaissance and actually putting them into action. And it's just four individuals who really understand soil well and soil health well. And what they basically do is match research dollars to those projects that will help close those gaps. And along with that, and that's a standalone organization that Noble stood up. Along with that, we recognized that the fastest way to build soil health was to really incorporate cover crops. And there are a lot of great producers out there that were well down this road. But there are all these limitations around, what you can grow in certain parts of the country. So, and also there's different desirable traits of cover crops. You want stronger root systems, you want bigger biomass, and it depends on whether you're, what you're trying to improve on that land. And so with that, the Foundation for Food and Ag Research and Noble each kicked in $3 million, and we developed this nationwide cover crop breeding network. And along with that, we created another coalition to beginning address the supply chain issues of cover crops. And it's a very neophyte type of industry right now without a lot of standardization and quality assurances that go along with it. And I'll come back later, Aaron, if we've got time, to just to talk about the seismic shift that would take place in agriculture today if we were to move our acreage of 17 and 20 million acres of cover crops to 150 or 200 million acres, which is where it's going to go. But it's going to shift our cropping rotations dramatically over this next decade. And so what's going to propel that is the whole idea of pumping more carbon into the ground. So we were approached by people that were carbon pioneers for the last 20 years. And with all the talks of the Paris agreements and so forth, people wanted to have a understanding of how are we going to move agriculture in the area of sequestering more carbon. And we didn't know if this was an area that we really wanted to dive into. We didn't know how much time and resources we could invest in it. But at the end of the day, we thought, well, if we're trying to build soil health, it takes carbon to do that. And perhaps that's the avenue that we need to take with people who have been working in the regulated offset markets and the carbon credit markets to begin to understand is that the message isn't carbon, the message is soil health, and carbon and clean and water quantity are going to fall out of that process. And so we decided to bring this group together, and we began to talk about the limitations and the barriers associated with the building carbon markets at the farm level. And we did the same thing we did with the Soil Renaissance. We built our informed group around farmers and ranchers, so impaired them with people that would come from the other end, the trading platform, if you will, and said, if you want inside the farm gate, talk to a farmer. This is what we need to do. And so fast forwarding to your point earlier, we agreed that what we're really talking about is getting a foundational base established on land. And our effort is to keep working agricultural lands working, and that's maximizing the production on those lands that really feeds the biology on that landscape. And so our effort was to change the conversation, focus on soil health, make sure that the foundation that we built was built around carbon, holding the amount of carbon you have and building on that carbon base, and then water quantity through building the water holding capacity in the soil, but then also the water quality, whether it's runoff or it's groundwater through filtration. And that's the base level of the market itself. And then as you begin to think about different ecosystems that would be that would fall out or that are created as a result of getting that base right, you can then begin to manage these other components. So nutrient management, manure management, biodiversity, all of these are ecosystems that you can stack on top of this. Well, that led us in then into the creation of this ecosystem service platform model. And with that, Aaron, we were asked to gather a bunch of folks together by people that came out of the carbon industry and looking at what happened to the carbon markets of 10 and 20 years ago, and why are carbon markets today stumbling out of the gate as it relates to agriculture. And recognizing these problems of the past, I didn't know if this was something that we really wanted to go down that pathway or not. But when we started thinking about soil health and building soil health, we know that putting carbon into the ground is the precursor to building soil health. And having carbon in the ground is necessary in order to filter water, to create clean water, and also build water holding capacity, so making sure that we're using less water. And so it seemed like a natural fit for us to engage in this discussion but change the conversation away from carbon markets and carbon sequestration and everything that can be so political in a conversation to a point where soil health is the answer to arriving at and achieving what everybody is looking for. That's conservation on the ground, that's carbon sequestration, pulling it out of the atmosphere, and at the same time providing clean and benefit and the benefits of water quality and quantity. And so we convened this group based on our previous recipe with the Soil Renaissance of making sure that it was farmer-facing and that we're taking farmers and ranchers who have an interest in this area and pairing them with people that came out of the carbon offset, regulated offset markets, and sitting there and saying, now talk to one another. This is what you want, and this is what you can achieve, and this is what you can provide. And through this, we managed to go through the difficulties of understanding the barriers associated in with the working with registries around areas of additionality and permanence, and we were able to find common ground as to what would work at a farm level and then what could potentially work with a buyer entity who are looking for these types of carbon offsets or insetting capabilities. And so once we felt like we have had this level of agreement, we moved forward to have conversations with registries about our ideas in this area. And they've agreed to work and develop protocols in the area of providing ecosystem service contracts or credits that can be traded on an open market. And with that, we now are beginning to develop our own pilot projects utilizing what we believe are good protocols and pathways to follow that we think will also marry up with what the registries are going to be requiring or requesting. But all of this is still in the infant stages of what it is that we're trying to achieve. Ultimately, I think January 2022 is our projected launch date. We want to have a collective group of buyers and sellers, buyers being anybody that has carbon offsets or insetting goals, corporate sustainability goals. It could be municipalities or utilities. That could be food companies who want to create supply chain opportunities where they can capitalize on knowing your farmer. And actually having the assurances that a box of Cheerios comes from this oat farmer in Kansas, just as an example, who farms with an ethic that provides optimal land stewardship. And then also with respect to water, I mean, you've got any distillery or brewery or municipality utilities that are all interested in ensuring that the quality of water that they're using and providing drinking water or what have you is as clean as it possibly can be. I'll make one other quick point. When we talk about ecosystem services, though, the premise is to create that baseline of carbon and water, and nothing else happens until you can achieve that level of success in building carbon and water and building water holding capacity and providing clean water off of your watershed. Then you're able to think about what are those other services that you can stack and provide as well, whether it's biodiversity or if it's manure management or nutrient management. Lots of different services that you can provide off of that landscape. But first and foremost, carbon and water have got to be in the prime spot.
Bill, that was wonderful. And what our audience doesn't know is that we lost power for 10 minutes there, and you were able to pick up where you left off and roll with the punches, and it came out fantastic. Well done. So I can't thank you. I'm even more impressed. That was wonderful. So that was very well done. And
the Northeast is getting your share of winter weather this year.
We are. We, you know, it's funny because everyone skated through February thinking, oh, it's easy. And it's just new, you know, no problem. We're going to have easy winter. And I don't know where those people come from, but you know, in New England, you're going to get it on the back end. It's going to come at some point. So we've been getting our fair share. So, you know, what I wanted to mention there, Bill, is one thing that you seem to gracefully handle the language so nicely. You don't make this a political conversation. Carbon quickly becomes a political conversation. conversation for many. And I think it's been an enlightening perspective to hear the way that you gracefully handle this and the way that you're able to explain this in the context that it makes sense for the producers. And I want to stay on that notion of the producers and how essential that is. So it seems that your sweet spot is definitely research and education of getting the information out, doing this cutting edge and bleeding edge research and getting the word out from the diverse disciplines, from agronomy and applied agriculture, cell biology, plant development, genomics, plant breeding, plant nutrition, plant physiology, plant transformation, genetic editing, and plant and microbial interactions. So what I find interesting is instead of going down that path and looking at this and maybe someone has a trigger that sends them in the wrong direction, you talk about no-till, cover crops, and nutrient cycling. Which is this the commonality in language that is going to get more folks to have a seat at that table from the producer side?
I agree with you, Aaron. I think so. I think, you know, definition is certainly a big part of communicating. We all have to define our terms and make sure that we all understand what it is that we're talking about. Lacking that creates problems. So I'll give you an example on gene editing. You mentioned that topic. Of course, the organic industry has come out and said we don't accept gene editing. And I've talked to a lot of organic farmers who believe gene editing has a role to play. You know, not every system works functionally better. Cover crops is one of those areas where you can gene edit a cover crop to develop a desired trait. And people, I think they need to understand that there's different types of gene editing technologies that can facilitate this. So one of the things that we've done is we've tried to work with the organic industry to point out the differences in gene editing. Because if the issue is I don't want to use a DNA that's foreign to the plant that I'm editing, then there is a gene edited platform for that. Then you educate people on the fact that there's other gene editing platforms where you use the RNA of the plant to create that desired trait. And when they see that and they understand that there's different types, then they become more accepting of that technology because they realize that plants in the natural environment are editing themselves every day through their RNA. And so it is a natural process. We're just using science and technology to understand how to do that. That's not to say the organic industry is going to run out and change their standards, but I think just having that conversation so you can take the fear factor out of it, unlike what we had with the GMO debates, because there is a pathway there for this technology, but it's going to take some time and trust, brought this up earlier, and understanding about what can take place. But
do you see
same time, you know, I respect their positions.
Yeah, Bill, do you see an opportunity for Noble to take a position on that, to actually start to break down what the difference is of transgenesis versus cisgenesis, and to then explain that cisgenesis is equivalent of grafting or expressing certain gene types and is a huge step forward in that ability to start to bring those variances forward to market and really to engage that consumer in some of the values that can be expressed and a huge step forward of what they think is some of the detrimental practices of GMOs, like editing genes to be resistant to glyphosate.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we do, you know, our mission is to solve agricultural's great challenges. Mm. And for me, that is one of them. So how do we continue to advance science and technology, in order to improve agriculture? And recognizing everybody's own ethic, I think, is important as we look at this and having that level of communication. Monsanto can't have this discussion with the organic industry. I'm hoping that we can, because I think we can talk about it in different terms and find that common ground. It may not work at the end of the day, but that doesn't mean that Noble's not going to try. We want to work with the National Organic Standards Board and explain the differences in gene editing technologies and which ones would fit into an organic system and which one wouldn't. And I think that's the key. I don't think people have to say that all of them fit. Find the ones that will fit. Find the technologies that will work and open that up a little bit. I think the Organic Farming and Research Foundation or the Rodell Institute could play a very important role in this whole element in order to allow that discussion to take place. But you do get people that just put a hand down and say no, and the organic folks are already having those discussions around hydroponics and soil, what constitutes organic. So they're going through a lot of gyrations right now themselves, and that kind of occupies a lot of time and space. But it's just a long way of saying that Noble is going to tackle this, and we're going to do our best that we can to kind of present that that different side, if you will.
So let's move on from the producer and start looking at maybe what the change agent in this country is going to be, which is the consumer. So if we move from the producer to the consumer and we start talking about what you're establishing for your ecosystems markets and looking at the environmental aspects that you're trying to quantify by commoditizing water, carbon, and soil health, does that set the framework up to start to decommoditize food so that when a consumer really understands what the impact on the environment is from the food that they're consuming or where they're voting with their dollar, doesn't that create an opportunity to create a new supply chain of food that's based off of multiple variables, that reduces externalities, that gets consumers engaged in that what they're putting in their body matters to their health, to environmental health, to their community's health?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, quite frankly, I think this is what's creating so much of the change today. We've got, I have millennial generation kids, and I don't like to call them millennials because I think millennials are starting to get a bad connotation. But they do vote with their dollar, and I say dollar, not plural. Because I think they are more conscious of what they are buying, and there is an ethic that's being developed with those kids and around making sure that what they do is they do good, and farmers are recognizing this, and they see that change, and they are wanting to adapt, and it's the whole farm, know your farmer, farm to table type of activities, the CSAs, all of this is happening for a reason. And your larger farmers in the Midwest are seeing this taking place. And a lot of them are starting to create shifts. We've got some large growers on our Soil Health Institute board farming upwards of 10 to 15,000 acres, and they're converting half their production to organic. I mean, those are huge shifts, and they're doing it to one is economically it's much better. So there's a supply side and a demand side that's going to have to play out over time in terms of how many people are getting into this, but also recognizing that most of our organic grains for further production in the food system are coming offshore, which lack that type of oversight. And so there are individuals that are, looking at how do we create pipelines to ensure that supply of food, because this is what consumers are expecting. And farmers are more than willing to adapt themselves to that demand. And then on the other side of that, we always have to recognize there's a large population in the United States that can't afford to pick and choose. And that's a whole nother societal issue. However, it does play a major role in our food system and how we begin to separate those two and quantify those two issues.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that won't change how farmers will move toward improving their landscape.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting because obviously, we have an opportunity with economies of scale to start developing these better practices. Finding those environmental markets like you're offering is a great way to coax farmers into this direction. And I also like to drop the statistic to express that this is not a fringe element anymore. We're talking about those millennials. Obviously, when you were speaking of they vote with a dollar, I thought you were going down the path that they just don't have the resources, because I have a peer that would joke that they don't have two nickels to rub together, but those two nickels chemicals that they find, they'll spend on better food. But what the statistic that shows with that is that within the next decade, that millennial group is expected to inherit over $43 trillion. So if we're looking at this as even just a pure pragmatic business approach of what we're going to do, and as to your point, if most of those products, those differentiated products with questionable integrity are coming internationally, boy, that is an opportunity for us to start looking differently at our agricultural infrastructure. And what you're creating in this research and this analysis and this cutting edge and bleeding edge technology to move it in that direction, boy, that is giving them the tools needed to progress this. And so let me jump into that and further that, because one of the things that is very prevalent on your website, and I know that you focus on because of the region that you represent, that is drought and water utilization. And this is a global problem. I mean, this is, we've had a bit of a protectionism here in the States where we've had an abundance of natural resources and water being one of them. But drought, as you say, is a regular occurrence in southern Great Plains. So right now, globally, 70% of available freshwater is currently used for agriculture. And much of the models that we have for conventional ag are very reliant on unlocking nutrients using water. And much of it becomes a runoff practice. And if we don't have that soil infrastructure, it's lost. There's no sponge to absorb that. So there's what we see from your website is also progressing these concepts around managing your herds properly in these situations, working with supplemental forage, culling your herds when needed, developing alternative revenues on your farms to deal with these drought, like alternative energies, or even dealing with fish pond aquaculture I saw on your website, which I found very interesting. So those are all great practices, and you're developing an intellectual property because of, again, almost being forced innovators here of where you are located in this part of the States where you have to deal with drought concerns. Do you see what you're developing down there as intellectual property and methodology that could be scaled not just here in the States but globally? And is that an opportunity, a unique identifier that could be owned for our future production models?
Well, absolutely, and you know, I always think that you know, necessity is the mother of all inventions, right? So when you sit back and you have that freedom to think and decide how to move forward, there was a great, let me back up and just say, there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal the other day. It's about how societies have lost that capability of thinking, and cities typically do a much better job of that because of the interaction that they have with people and trading the ideas. They're bumping into people all the time. They're just this constant churn of discussion and ideas. And whereas in rural communities, you just don't have that same churning of people with new ideas and moving into areas and moving out. So the gist of the article was, is that, you know, the loss of ideology and the loss of vision occurs more quickly in a rural community than it does in the cities. And you can take that back in also into a corporation or into a research institute like we have. If we're not constantly collaborating, bringing people in, visiting scientists, working with folks like yourself, understanding new ideas, we become stagnated. Our ideas aren't fresh. And and that's where we have to keep on creating a thought process around innovating. And when we do that, I do believe there are great things that come out of areas like this because we're forced to be thinking all the time. But you can also get very complacent and just recognize that it is the way it is, and that's what's happened a lot to the cattle industry. There hasn't been a lot of technological changes in the cattle industry, and so what we try to think of is that, you know, let's talk about smart ranch technologies. How do we measure more impactfully the pound of gain off of a given forage that is under a particular amount of stress? You know, what is it that you're going to try to monitor, or how do you get more growth and more drought tolerance out of these plants? And so there is an amount of intellectual property that moves, that can move that through. This is why we're interested in gene editing. You know, there's all sorts of great examples of plants that are drought tolerant that we can begin incorporating and into the system once we begin to mapping the genome and have a better understanding of what those possibilities actually are. But it takes a long time in order to facilitate that. But when you start thinking about, and this going back to soil health, what is that optimal, what's the optimal health of soil in the southern Great Plains versus the optimal health of soil in New Hampshire? And they're vastly different. But each one has its own microbial life that allows that soil to function if it's taken care of. And so we're unlocking opportunities of looking at different mycorrhiza fungi and how that signals in the signaling capability between a mycorrhiza fungi and the plant root itself in terms of either allowing the plant to take in more nutrients or more water or what have you. And so that whole relationship and function is the area of soil biology that I was talking about earlier that we really haven't unlocked. And that forces us here to really look below the ground and develop those relationships to better understand what's taking place. And fortunately for us, there's a lot of people around the country, too, that are diving into this. And so we're able to kind of a citizen science approach, share this information back and forth to really begin understanding what's taking place. And recognizing too that you know there's intellectual property that companies will take to profit off of, and that's fine. Our effort is to really take it and expand that information and knowledge base.
So let's for my last question, I want to bring it full circle here and talk about the optimal biology and talk about the water utilization and talk about soil health through something that you had mentioned earlier, which is the goal or the plan to move from our cover crop utilization of 17 to 20 million acres up to 150 to 200 million acres of cover crop on these grasslands and what that really would represent for benefiting our optimal biology and our soil health. So maybe you could share a bit of what your analysis has shown of what that will require and some of your goals or objectives to get there.
Sure. Well, we do know that once we are able to talk about an ecosystem platform, and when we talk about farmers being in a free market where they're being paid to put conservation on the ground by a buyer market, most of that conservation on the ground that they're going to utilize to build soil health is going to be cover crops. And when people ask us what's the potential acreage for an ecosystem market, how many farmers and ranchers would actually participate, my response is always all of them. Why wouldn't they? If there's a period of time that they can begin to think about this movement, it's a program, if you will, that can last for several decades. So it's not going to happen overnight, but I could see, Aaron, the uptake of these types of programs happening and scaling very rapidly. And the problem is when we start thinking about the base acreage that's required of a cover crop, you know, and we're utilizing cereal rye in most cases, there's not enough cereal rye available to meet that demand. We even have shortages even this year to meet the demand of the different cover crop species. And so how do you begin to bring that cover crop industry together, that seed growers and seed companies together to agree to standards, agree to certain levels of quality and delivery, but also then beginning to understand and sharing information around which biological mix, diversified mix of cover crops works best in a given region. And because there's 96 different varieties we tested last year, and we found out that 12 of those are optimal for our area. And so we would focus on those 12 and recommending those to the farmers and ranchers that we work with. But where are we going to get enough cover crop seed produced of those 12? And so that's the dilemma that we have in a supply chain. So if we went to 100 million acres, we know that we would have to convert every winter wheat acre in Oklahoma to cereal rye production just to meet that demand for, as cereal rye as a base cover crop. And you start moving that that information across the country from 100 million acres to 150 to 200 million, you'll see your traditional farmers start setting aside certain acreage as an allocation to produce cover crop seed. So you're pulling crops out of production that have typically been part of that supply chain and part of that demand chain, if you will, and you're replacing it with something else. And all of that's good from the standpoint that this is what we need to build soil health, is diversity and moving out of the monoculture type of mindsets that we have. So when that starts moving in that direction, you're going to see this huge shift of acreage, predominantly corn and soybean and wheat acreages, to other things, just to get that cover crop fit into that rotation. And the other aspect of this is when farmers and ranchers are successful with their progress and their journey toward providing optimal soil health, their input use goes down. And that's, there's enough empirical evidence of producers across the country that can validate that. And when that goes down, you're also creating a shift in how ag retailers will traditionally be supplying products during those busy times of years. And the impact they'll have will be on synthetic fertilizers and chemistry. So ag chem companies, seed companies, fertilizer companies are all going to have to recognize that model is going to change over the next 10 to 20 years. And what is that going to do to their business models and trying to modify or make those changes? And so producers are moving in that direction, and I'm not trying to create a Chicken Little type of environment. I'm just stating, go talk to all of these farmers and find out what their desire and their interest is and the investments that they've made to date and how that's changed their farming operation. And if they would take the time to do that, they'll recognize that this change is going to be pretty large. So that's kind of how we see this world moving as we focus on soil health, carbon, using cover crops, impact on supply chains moving forward into the future.
That is fascinating and enlightening. And unlike our 1986 first baseman Bill Buckner, I have a feeling nothing gets by this Bill Buckner. So, Bill, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat with us. What an honor it was, and what an opportunity for us to learn. Where can our listening audience learn more about what you're up to at the Noble Research Institute?
www.noble.org.
I'll include a link on the write-up so people can take a listen, and I would encourage them to take a look at some of the projects that you're working on. So that was a fascinating conversation. All I can say is until the next time we chat, and maybe for a part two where we can go even further under the hood, I welcome that as a future opportunity if you're game.
Absolutely, Aaron, and I appreciate all the work you're doing up there.
Well, thank you very much. And Bill, great talking to you, and take care.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.